thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. Gene Moore is guest hosting today's program.
My guest is Dr. Dorothy Height, venerable civil rights leader and advocate on women's issues over several decades. Our conversation was held in the restaurant area of the Marriott Hotel in Philadelphia following the completion of her visit to Philadelphia for a national convention. I made arrangements for this interview through telephone conversations with a series of Delta Sigma Theta Sorors as intermediaries to finally make a successful contact with Dr. Height's traveling companion, who explained time would be very limited. Well, when I located Dr. Height, I found her seated at a table with a half dozen other people, eating breakfast and deep in conversation at the far end of the bustling dining room of the Marriott Hotel. While waiting for Dr. Height to finish her breakfast, recognizing these were several members of her family and close friends, I was seated at a nearby table. I sat and observed her. Well known for her beautiful hats, she wore a large, picture-perfect blue chapeau, perfectly matching her silk jacket and her softly printed blouse. It tilted slightly upward, framing her distinguished face in high-fashioned elegance. I began to think. I thought of this strong lady and the many years that she had lived and all that I had heard about her. I knew that she had spent some time in New York and was waiting to ask her some questions about the Harlem YWCA. After all, I was a New Yorker too. My childhood memory was of another special young lady who had worked at the branch of the YWCA in Harlem and who had died a tragic death. I wondered if Dr. Height might have even known her. Most of all, though, I was curious to ask her about her relationship with Delta Sigma Theta Sorority. This is my sorority, too, and her name is sacred when the sorority is discussed among members of the sisterhood throughout the country. I wondered where she had been initiated into the sorority. I would ask her. I had heard the true story also that Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, wife of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had visited Dr. Height when she was hospitalized in Washington, D.C., after a very bad accident. Of course, Washington was highly segregated during that time, and Mrs. Roosevelt's entrance must have caused quite a stir to the white nurses when Mrs. Roosevelt asked for Miss Height, please. Her stories are legend, including her worldwide involvement in matters of justice, such as the World Conference Against Racism held in Durban, South Africa in 2001. Her indefatigable fight and success in integrating all of the YWCAs throughout the United States. She actually had been barred from entering a swimming pool in one of the Ys when she was a child. Her strong role in the civil rights movement, including the March on Washington, without regard to credit and self-acclamation for all of the work she did in planning it. Her commitment to integration, to equity and justice for blacks, and for the advancement of the many causes so dear to women around the world. I sat thinking of what had happened in Mississippi, where I knew she had done so much to ease racial tensions. In so many ways, I felt a close connection to her. After all, she is a professionally trained social worker, and that's my profession too. I wish that I had been around during those heady days of the Harlem Renaissance to meet the people that she met and to go to some of those jazz clubs with W.C. Handy. But more immediately, the time. I was now making urgent gestures to her PR person. I was pointing to my watch, and I began moving up to the table to be sure that I would finally have the opportunity to say,
Dr. Height, I am so pleased to be here with you and to talk with you after many years of knowing you as my soror in Delta Sigma Theta. Thank you for letting me sit at the table with you.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased and honored to have an opportunity to talk with you.
Well, so many times they say you have sat at the table and been at the table with many people, but I think they had the opportunity of having to sit at the table with you because you were the most important person in so many eras in relationship, particularly to civil rights.
Well, thank you. Whatever, wherever I've been, I've tried to do my best.
I know that you have done more than your best, and many have really received much from what you have put out over the years. Let me take you back a little bit, though, to how you began. You were born in Richmond, Virginia, is that right?
Yes. I was born in Richmond, Virginia, but when I was 4 years old, my parents moved to Pennsylvania to a little town called Rankin, which is a borough of Pittsburgh.
I understand you made a good debating person during those years.
Yes, during my high school days, I participated in all the things related to speech, debating, impromptu speech contests, oratory, did a whole lot of it.
Do you have many siblings?
Yes, I have. Living now, I have two sisters. But I had three sisters and two brothers.
So you came from a nice-sized family.
Yes, it really was, although there were only two of us who grew up together. We came late in our parents' lives. We were their last two children, and so we grew up together.
Now, how did you get to New York? Because I know you've had some time in New York City.
Well, in 1929, I graduated from Rankin High School, and I went to New York to go to college. So I've been a New Yorker ever since.
Now, I was born and raised in New York, and I went to college there, too. Where did you go to college in New York?
I literally went to New York University. And I also did some work at Columbia University.
I was a Hunter person, Hunter College.
Well, I knew Hunter, and many times we as students at New York University, City College, and Hunter College all got together. In fact, we formed what was called the Ramses, a club that was focused on our African heritage.
Do you recall at the YWCA, when you started working there, do you recall a young woman there named Miss Hunter?
At the YWCA, oh yes.
Yeah. Olivia Hunter, I think she was?
Olivia Hunter, yes.
I remember her well, and I recall her tragic death.
Well, I had my role at the YWCA when I went there. I was the assistant executive director, and then later the residence director, so that I pretty much was in touch with all of those young women who came to live or to work at the YWCA.
Now, you've done so much with the Y over the years. It seems as though you did not only the cutting of your career beginning there, but gave a lot to the growth of that organization.
Well, I had the rare opportunity to be on the National YWCA staff at the time of when the YWCA was really the first major national organization in this country whose leadership and membership were drawn from predominantly the white majority. It was the first organization to pass an interracial charter in 1946, and that was before 1954 when you had the Brown versus Board of Education decision ultimately stating that segregation was illegal and unconstitutional. So the YWCA, for me, was a rich experience because I had the opportunity to work from that day through until in 1970, the YWCA had completely advanced and adopted as its one imperative to thrust our collective power against it, to eliminate racism wherever it exists and by any means necessary.
It's marvelous that the Y has had so much impact over the years, and yet I'm sure the togetherness of the African-American community with the Y, even with integration, it may have had some impact on what happens in certain communities. Even today, not only the YW, but the YM somehow have to struggle in those areas that are predominantly African-American to continue to exist.
Well, I do have to say that I think the YWCA, though, stands alone in the way it advanced black women as professionals, because in 1895, when it organized in Dayton, Ohio, it gave the first opportunity to what was called then a Negro woman to be an executive. And in 1912, it employed the first national staff, Elizabeth Roth Haynes. So I don't think you will find a match to that history. And that one of the advantages in the YWCA, even in the days when it had separate racial branches, was that it offered the opportunity for women as professionals to develop and to be in management position as well as in program opportunities.
Another of your areas that is so dear to your heart and also to mine is the sorority, Delta Sigma Theta. When and through what method did you become a Delta?
I became a Delta while I was working at the Harlem YWCA in 1939. And I attended then my first convention. And actually then, 6 years later, I was elected as a vice president of the National and then later as president. So that I have had a long history, and when it is said that I served as president longer than any other person, it was because I came into office at a time when all of the sororities and fraternities were exceedingly social. And I had a hand in helping the sorority move toward a more activist position. I was also there to employ the first staff and to establish and purchase the first headquarters. So that Delta Sigma Theta has been really a part of my life, and I think I've made a contribution to it.
More than a contribution, you really pulled it to the point where it was recognized as such an active sorority, and which took some of us to that sorority. When I came along, there were no campus Delta Sigma Theta chapters in the City College area, and we had off-campus. And the only reason some of us joined was because of the active nature of the organization. I'm sure, to you.
Yes, I myself came into Road Chapter, which was not on any college, but it was what they call a citywide chapter, and drew young women from all the different colleges.
That's my chapter too, Sora. Road Chapter.
Road Chapter, it's very interesting.
I'm so amazed at all that you have done over the years, and to see how so much of this has articulated from the YWCA and then Delta Sigma Theta, and of course the area for which you are so well known as the President Emerita of the National Council on Negro Women. What inspired you to get involved with that group?
Well, in 1937, I had the assignment to escort Eleanor Roosevelt into a meeting Mrs. Bethune was holding at the Harlem branch of the YWCA. And as I was bringing Mrs. Roosevelt out, Mrs. Bethune asked me my name, and I told her. She said, "Come back, we need you," and I've been back ever since. And it's her words where she said, "The freedom gates are half ajar. We must pry them fully open." That led me to write my memoirs and to use the title Open Wide the Freedom Gates. And I've been working it ever since.
Talk a little bit about some of the activities involved in that organization over the years and why it is so important still.
Well, the National Council of Negro Women has played a major role in the working for the advancement of black women and their families and their communities. We launched housing for low-income families. We've worked with developing food banks, and right now we're focusing on education, on health, helping to deal with the disparities in health, and of course in family life and trying to help to build and strengthen, build on our families, and to help to use the resilience that's in our families to help us make stronger ones.
You, through that vehicle, also touched so many other leaders throughout the country during the civil rights movement. How did you become that much involved to the point where, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, that you sat at the table and they were eager, they being many of the males who were involved in the civil rights struggle? How did you become that involved?
Well, it was, we had been doing some work and studying together, and under the Connick Foundation, Whitney Young, Roy Wilkins, A. Philip Randolph, Martin Luther King Jr., James Farmer, and James Farmer and I. And when Medgar Evers was assassinated, Connick Foundation asked us all to come together and to see what we could do. And out of that grew what we call this Council of United Civil Rights Leadership. And I was the woman member of that group. And we worked with the White House and with the Congress and all to get the Voting Rights Act of 60, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, and of course the Fair Housing Act, all of the civil rights legislation we worked hard to put together.
From what I remember and what I have observed, though, you had a great deal to taking leadership roles in that. I know you work together with them, but so often the women have not been given the credit for all that they really do in some of these issues.
Well, I think you're right. The role of women has not been fully recognized, but my role in the United Civil Rights Group was to really keep alive the issues related to women, to families, but also the basic human needs, hunger, malnutrition, bad housing, unemployment, and so each one made a distinctive contribution. The NAACP was specialist on law, and so on it went. And I think that was part of the strength, that we knew that unity did not mean uniformity, but that each one of us had to make a special contribution, and I tried to make it.
You're listening to University Forum. My guest is Dr. Dorothy Height, strong civil rights leader and longtime advocate on women's issues over several decades, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Bill Clinton. She was awarded also the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Freedom Medal and the Citizens Medal Award from President Ronald Reagan in 1989. I continue with our conversation, which took place on location in the restaurant of the Marriott Hotel in Philadelphia.
Would you talk a bit about Mississippi and the women and the relationship to a special project you had there?
One of the special things that we did during the summer of 64, when Bob Moses set up the Freedom Schools in Mississippi, was that we gathered through the National Council of Negro Women interracial teams of women who went into Mississippi every week and spent Wednesday there. And they prepared on Tuesday and spent Wednesday working in the community and in the schools. And then we came out on Thursday morning, so that this was an effort really to support the young people who were working for freedom and for opportunity.
But you were bringing together, probably for the first time for many of them, black and white women together.
Yes, for many of them it was their first time, for many of the white women it was their first time, but also for everyone it was the first time that black and white women had worked together openly in the cause of civil rights.
In her book, Dr. Height indicates, quote, "We decided that the trips would begin on Tuesdays and end on Thursdays in Jackson. The intervening Wednesdays would be spent visiting COFO projects in places like Hattiesburg, Canton, Meridian, Vicksburg, and Relleville. We called the project Wednesdays in Mississippi. It was sponsored by the National Council of Negro Women with participation by the YWCA, United Church Women, the National Council of Catholic Women, the National Council of Jewish Women, the League of Women Voters, and the American Association of University Women." I continue the quote from her book. "In Mississippi, in 1964, it was very difficult to know
who in the white community was a potential friend. In the end, we were blessed with a handful of angels, black and white Mississippi women, who worked with us 100% as we set out to demonstrate that women of goodwill, white and black, northern and southern, Christian and Jewish, could come together to quell violence, ease tensions, and inspire tolerance in racially torn communities. Without the courage and support of our Mississippi women friend, we never could have begun, much less sustained the Wednesdays in Mississippi project. A June memorandum to WIMS participants stated our official mission. Quote, "We believe it is important that private citizens of stature and influence make it known that they support the aspirations of the citizens of Mississippi for full citizenship, and that they deplore violence, and that they will place themselves in tension-filled situations to try to initiate both understanding and reconciliation." End quote of that memorandum. I continue quoting from her book. The specific goals of the project were to establish lines of communication among women of goodwill across regional and racial lines, to observe the COFO student projects and discuss them with local Mississippi women, and to lend a ministry of presence as witnesses to encourage compassion and reconciliation. Her book details the experiences, including the physical dangers that these women encountered during that summer. She quotes an After Labor Day 1964 New York Times headline about the Wednesdays in Mississippi project as, "Women tear down the cotton curtain." By agreement, Wednesdays in Mississippi continued in 1965. Quote, "The Mississippi women who participated were influential Negro and white women representing a broad range of Southern opinion. Militant segregationists were the only ones who weren't involved. All told, 47 women from the North, the West, and the East made the trip south that second summer." End quote. These excerpts from Dr. Height's book, Open Wide the Freedom Gates, cover only one example of her extensive involvement in the struggle for justice and equality throughout her lifetime, which she continues to commit to the cause of equality and justice today. You have really gone global with your message, have you not?
Yes, and since 1975, we have been working internationally. We have been working with African countries. I personally have worked on every five of the continents, and we've had a great opportunity, but I think we're seeing that we have to close ranks and join our sisters from different parts of the world to work together. And the United Nations Decade for Women helped that, and the conferences, and we were part of every single one of them. And in each one brought together women, especially those from the African diaspora.
I remember the one in Nairobi, in which the women who came from Africa, South Africa, were really at quite a great risk.
Yes. Those women came, they were threatened, but they came nevertheless because they were seeking something. And I think that's the other thing, that we often overlook the strength that is in African women and in African American women, and how we are not only survivors, but we achieve against the odds.
And yet you have, as you say, been on every continent, and you see the theme that runs through all women around the world.
Women everywhere want the same thing. They want a better life for themselves, for their children, for their families. They want to contribute. They want to be a part of decision-making bodies at every level in their country. And they know they have the talent. They just want to have the opportunity to develop it and make their contribution.
As you think back over the years, and you are now how old?
91.
People tend to try to pigeonhole us when we get into certain age brackets, do they not?
Well, I guess they do, but, you know, one thing you have to do is just keep going on.
Yeah. I talked with an elderly person the other day, and she said, age is just a matter of mind, and if you don't mind, it doesn't matter.
That is absolutely true. That's a good way to put it.
Would you tell me what, over the years, has been your greatest challenge in work that you've done?
Well, I think my greatest challenge has been that of trying to hold the course and keep moving, because you have so many things to distract you, so many disappointments, so many problems, so many mountains that you have to move, but you also have to keep going. And I have tried to keep pursuing my course and put all that I have into it.
Just one or two last questions for you. Who or what has been your greatest inspiration over the years?
Well, I would have to start with my mother. But in addition, I would say that Mrs. Bethune and Eleanor Roosevelt were two great figures in my life who to me were not, I don't say models, because I'm not sure what a model is, but they were mentors and they helped me to clarify my own objectives. And I think every person has to decide for themselves what they want to do for their lives, with their lives, and how they'll make a contribution. And those two women, for me, were people who exemplified that kind of pursuit and that kind of determination.
A very special thanks to my friend Dr. Gene Moore for guest hosting the program.
If you ever find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many more on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you, and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.